Blog Talk Radio.
There's a better world that's coming, tell you why. There's a better world that's coming, tell you why. We will feed them on the land, on the sea and in the sky. There's a better world that's coming, tell you why. There's a better world that's coming, don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world that's coming, don't you see?
Good evening once again, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Rick Spezak, news director of Progressive News Network. How are you doing tonight? I hope you're doing well. There's a lot of good things going on and some things we need to work on, too. I want to go over a couple news items with you. It's very important. First thing I want to mention to you is the death count is over 1,000 in that factory in Bangladesh. I hope those of you who patronize Walmart will think twice before you do it. And if you do, I want you to urge them to think about the high cost of those low prices. Another story I want to mention to you is that I very rarely recommend an editorial in the Palm Beach Post. But boy, there's one today that should get your blood percolating. It's a news story called Scott Should Veto the Legislature's Foreclosure Bill. Of all the things that should be done with foreclosures, the last thing in the world that should be done is to speed up the process so the people defending their right to hold their homes are eroded and the bankers get a speed up. The editorial goes something like this. Scott Should Veto the Legislature's Foreclosure Bill by Rhonda Swan, Palm Beach Post staff writer. Legislatures finally passed a bill to ease Florida's foreclosure crisis. The problem is it's a bad bill that Governor Scott should veto. Representative Kathleen Pasidomo, Republican of Naples, sponsor the bill 87, believes that giving banks the right to seek a quicker hearing would get the state's 350,000 foreclosure cases resolved faster. Her approach might make sense if banks weren't causing the backlog by not acting on the cases that they file. Although some homeowners employ attorneys who are responsible for delays, the vast majority are at the mercy of lenders who set the timetable for how quickly cases move or don't move. It takes an average of 2 years to dispose of foreclosure lawsuits in Florida because too often lenders and servicers don't want to assume the taxes, association dues, and expenses to list a house for sale that they incur after taking possession. They also don't want a glut of foreclosure depressing prices and furthering their losses, so they let cases languish. On Friday, the backlog prompted the Florida Supreme Court to order the trial courts hire magistrates to move the cases. HB 87 would let lenders seek a show cause hearing, forcing homeowners into court quickly to prove they shouldn't be foreclosed on. That would not light a fire under the banks. Thousands of foreclosure cases staffed following a scandal of thousands of foreclosure cases stalled following a scandal in which lenders allegedly faked documents and improperly foreclosed on thousands of homeowners, some of whom were current on their mortgages. The nation's five largest banks agreed to a $25 billion settlement with federal regulators. The deal was supposed to force the lenders to lower interest rates, reduce principal, or offer cash to struggling homeowners. That would actually reduce the rate of foreclosures. New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman said that Wells Fargo Bank and Bank of America are in flagrant violation of the settlement. He's planning to sue them. The state has received 349 complaints against the two banks in 6 months, but the monitor of the National Mortgage Settlement has received 629 complaints from Florida alone. That doesn't include at least 1,000 complaints made to Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi's office. Two-thirds are against Wells Fargo and Bank of America. I urge you to read that article. It's an important one. And if you're a participant in Bank of America and Wells Fargo, let them know what you think about those practices. Another story that's important you should know about is that there's a new assault on food stamps taking place in the legislature, and Jamie Dimon is going to profit all the way. This is from an article in Fire Dog Lake written by a gentleman named Ohio Barbarian. He said attacking the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program called SNAP now, which the old name for food stamps. The bad news is the Democratic chairman of the Senate Agricultural Committee, Debbie Stabenow, only wants to cut SNAP benefits by 5.5%. The worst news is the Republicans want to cut it a lot more. That great libertarian hero, Rand Paul, wants to cut the program by $45 billion a year until $322 billion in savings is achieved. Americans would be flabbergasted if they knew how much money is spent on food stamps, Paul intoned. Fortunately, his amendment was shot down in flames, with 13 Republicans joining all the Senate Democrats in killing it. Whether they were motivated by lost revenue in corporations like Walmart and J.P. Morgan Chase or fear of rioting is unclear. J.P. Morgan Chase, how do they profit? Why, yes, Jamie Dimon profits handsomely off the SNAP program and has for some time. J.P., you see, makes many of the EBT cards that SNAP recipients use, and it charges them a quarter every time they just check their balance. How'd you like that? Pretty neat, huh? Another story I'd like you to call your attention to is Penny a Pound Plus Power, a coalition of Immokalee workers in changes history. They've not only succeeded in getting many of the vendors to increase the price, they're going to Wendy's shareholders meeting in New York on the 18th to try to get them to change their price as well. They've made some really remarkable progress, a story you should know, a success story by the Immokalee workers. Another story you should know about is this is called a Digital Fishing Trawler, a story from Who, What, Why by Christian Stork. Prosecution of Barrett Brown is an over-prosecution, attorney Jason Flores-Williams told Who, What, Why. A member of the recently conceived Whistleblower Defense League, he had originally filed a motion to quash the subpoena on behalf of a third party. His then-client, a Dutch national who had built a news-gathering site for Mr. Brown, eventually declined to proceed, paving the way for it to go forward. The DOJ and the prosecution go on a fishing expedition to see who may be out there investigating the activities of their own government, and that in return the era of McCarthy. Interconnected structure of the Internet enables such viral subpoenas whereby private information about almost anybody within a particular network, they say, journalists accessing information published by Project PM, can be collected under the auspices of a single indictment. Okay, another story I want to get your attention to is, let's see, there's continuing quakes in Fukushima, and they're lately, hey, that old terror bugaboo is raising its head. They're now having exercises practicing to protect against terrorism, because, of course, all that spent fuel pools are just sitting out. Norman Solomon got an article in Truth Out on the President Obama's recent corporately friendly 1% nominees. He mentions that to nominate Penny Pritzker for the Secretary of Commerce is to throw in the towel on any pretense of integrity that could pass a laugh test. Pritzker is a longtime political supporter and heavyweight fundraiser. The Chicago Tribune reported that with a notable understatement last week, adding, she's on the board of Hyatt Hotels Corp., which was founded by her family, and has had rocky relations with labor unions, and she could face questions about the failure of a bank partly owned by her family. With a personal fortune estimated at $1.85 billion, Pritzker is listed in Forbes magazine among the 300 wealthiest Americans. A more blunt assessment came from journalist Dennis Bernstein. Her pioneering subprime operations out of Superior Bank in Chicago specifically targeted poor and working-class people of color across the country. She ended up crashing Superior for a $1 billion cost to taxpayers and created a personal tragedy for 1,400 people who lost their savings when the bank failed. Pritzker, whose family controls Hyatt Regency Hotels, has a vile anti-union record. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're just about out of time and ready to introduce our associate producer, Ms. Renee Shaker. Renee, welcome.
Thanks, Rick. I came in a little bit late on your mortgage story, but there was an article just this past week in the New York Times. New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman is gearing up lawsuits against Bank of America and Wells Fargo for the mortgage abuses in the foreclosure process that you outlined. So it's not going without attention in some circles. Anyhow, I want to give a shout-out today to all mothers, it being Mother's Day, and my readings from the press are going to Mother Nature. So I've got three pieces that I want to bring everybody's attention to. I'm going to start off with the bad news first. This was an article in just yesterday's front page New York Times. Heat-trapping gas passes milestone, raising fears, by Justin Gillis. The level of the most important heat-trapping gas in the atmosphere, carbon dioxide, has passed a long-feared milestone, scientists reported Friday, reaching a concentration not seen on Earth for millions of years. Scientific instruments show that the gas had reached an average daily level of 40,000 parts per million. Just an odometer moment in one sense, but also a sobering reminder that decades of efforts to bring human-produced emissions under control are faltering. The best available evidence suggests the amount of gas in the air has not been this high for at least 3 million years before humans even evolved, and scientists believe the rise portends large changes in climate and the level of sea. It symbolizes so far we have failed miserably in tackling this problem, says Peter Tans, who runs the monitoring program at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration that reported the new reading. Ralph Keeling, who runs another monitoring program at the Scripps Institute of Oceanography in San Diego, said a continuing rise could be catastrophic. It means we are quickly losing the possibility of keeping the climate below what people thought were possibly tolerable thresholds. Virtually every automobile ride, every plane trip, and in most places, every flip of a light switch adds carbon dioxide to the air, and relatively little money is being spent to find and deploy alternative technologies. China is now the largest emitter, but Americans have been consuming fossil fuels extensively for far longer, and experts say the United States is more responsible than any other nation for this high level. Carbon dioxide rises and falls on a seasonal and cyclical level, and the level will dip between below 40,000 parts this summer as leaf growth in the northern hemisphere pulls about 10 billion tons of carbon out of the air. But experts say that will be a brief reprieve. The moment is fast approaching when no measurement of the ambient air anywhere on Earth in any season will produce a reading below 40,000. It feels like the inevitable march towards disaster, says Maureen Ramo, a scientist at the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory, a unit of Columbia University. For the entire period of human civilization, roughly 8,000 years, the carbon dioxide level was relatively stable near the upper band, but the burning of fossil fuels has caused a 41% increase in heat-trapping gas since the Industrial Revolution. And scientists say the climate is beginning to react, though they expect far larger changes in the future. Going on here, it's Richard Ailey, a climate scientist at Pennsylvania State University, says if you start turning the Titanic long before you hit the iceberg, you can go clear without even spilling a drink of a passenger on deck. But if you wait until you're really close, like we are now, spilling a lot of drinks is the best you can hope for. Unfortunately, climate change contrarians who have little scientific credibility but are politically influential in Washington point out that carbon dioxide represents only a tiny fraction of the air. A Republican congressman says the CO2 levels in the atmosphere are rather undramatic. However, climate scientists reject that argument, saying it is like claiming that a tiny bit of arsenic or cobra venom cannot have much effect. Research shows that even at such low levels, carbon dioxide is potent at trapping heat near the surface of the Earth. If you're looking to stave off climate perturbations that I don't believe our culture is ready to adapt to, then significant reductions in CO2 emissions have to occur right away, says Mark Pagani, a Yale geochemist who studies climates of the past. I feel like the time to do something was yesterday. Pretty sobering news. However, I have two more articles that looks as if there may be a glimmer of hope on the horizon. Certainly not anything that is going to get anybody terribly excited, but sometimes the small steps are the important ones. The recent issue of New York Magazine that came out this past week has an article by Jonathan Chaitz on the Obama environmental policy entitled "Obama Might Actually Be the Environmental President." As far as State of the Union addresses go, this last one was no big deal. Usually, it's a list of never-going-to-happen goals that are woven into idealistic catchphrases, analyzed as rhetoric by an unqualified panel of poetry critic for a night political reporters, quickly followed by a hapless opposition party response, and then, in almost every case, sadly forgotten. However, this year, Obama made the comment that was considered momentous, and his comment was, "I will direct my cabinet," he announced, "to come up with extensive actions we can take now and in the future to reduce pollution, prepare our communities for the consequences of climate change, and speed the transition to more sustainable energy sources." Here was a genuine bombshell. It sounded a little vague, and the president did not explain precisely what he intended to do or how he would pull it off. But a handful of environmental wonks have a fairly strong grasp of the project he had committed himself to do said that if they were to summarize the news, the headline would have been "Obama to save the planet." Unfortunately, Obama's announcement has been shrouded in the pervasive miasma of failure, the stench of too little, too late, that has surrounded his climate agenda. Matters appear only to have gotten worse since then, especially as climate activists chain themselves to the White House gate to protest the president's likely approval of the Keystone Pipeline, where Obama himself is taking an apologetic tone. The assumption that Obama's climate change record is essentially one of failure is mainly an artifact of environmentalists and understandable frantic urgency, the sort of steady progress that would leave activists on other issues giddy does not satisfy the sort of person whose waking hours are spent watching the glaciers melt irreversibly. But there is a difference between failing to do anything and failing to do enough. And even those who criticize the president's efforts as inadequate ought to be clear-eyed about what has been accomplished. By the normal standards of progress, Obama has amassed an impressive record so far on climate change. The article goes on to mention that the first measure is what has been done. And the question is, how much carbon are we emitting in the atmosphere? As it happens, after decades of rising carbon dioxide emissions in the United States, these emissions started falling in 2008, and they have kept falling. By the end of last year, emissions have fallen almost 12% below the 2005 level. That is to say, we have reached two-thirds of the goal of reducing emissions by 17%. Now, admittedly, a lot of this is not due to anything Obama has done. About half of these emissions are attributable to the recession. People cut back on spending, they drive less, they don't run their air conditioner as much, and so on. Still, even if the progress was temporary and mainly the result of luck, it has provided Obama with breathing room that most observers haven't been willing to grant him. So the second way to measure Obama's climate change record is, what has he done? And the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act did contain upwards of $90 billion in subsidies for green energy, which had a catalyzing effect on burgeoning industries. American wind power generation has doubled, and solar power has increased more than six times over. As Time Magazine's Michael Grunwald detailed in a new book called The New New Deal, the new law suddenly transformed the Department of Energy, previously a scholastic backwater, charged Maine with overseeing the nuclear weapons cache, into a massive new engine of cutting-edge environmental science. Unfortunately, as we all know, Salinger was picked up by the Republicans in the press as an example of the failures of the Obama administration. But nevertheless, the new stimulus finance research projects to increase energy content of natural gas is another important byproduct of that act. The administration has also carried out an ambitious program of regulation, having imposed or announced higher standards for gas mileage in cars, fuel cleanliness, energy efficiency in appliances, and emissions from new power plants. In aggregate, they amount to a major assault on climate change. The article goes on to say that some environmentalists judge them to be insufficient, which is a fair critique, but many more Obama supporters aren't even aware that they exist. Last August, for example, the administration announced it was ratcheting up vehicle fuel efficiency standards from 29.7 miles per gallon to 54.5 miles per gallon, and the administration announced new standards for cleaner gasoline. What's happening is the political theater has played itself out, unfortunately, on the two front page items, which is the Keystone Pipeline and the failure of the cap and trade bill in 2010. However, the article goes on to say that these are not the last words and not the last best chance to deal with global warming during the remainder of Obama's term. There is one more major item. In December of 1970, Richard Nixon signed the Clean Air Act. Scientists at the time did not recognize that carbon dioxide contributed to global warming. They were more concerned with carbon monoxide and other chemicals. But as the scientific case for climate change hardened, environmentalists filed suit to force the EPA to regulate carbon emissions, like other pollutants. And in 2007, the Supreme Court ruled in the environmentalists' favor. In 2008, they went to the White House. Unfortunately, Bush sat on them and didn't even open his email. But after the cap-and-trade failure, Obama started using the agency's regulatory powers directly in the environmental favor. However, there's one big hole in the regulatory agenda, and that is power plants. Unfortunately, it is a very large hole because these plants, mostly coal-burning plants, emit 40% of all U.S. carbon emissions. Coal is so inherently dirty that no available technology can prevent a plant from emitting unacceptable levels of greenhouse gases. That is, unless you shut them all down. However, you really can't do that. It's just not possible. What the administration is doing is it's looking at a plan that was put forth by the National Resources Defense Council. A few weeks after this past election, the NRDC published a plan for the EPA to regulate existing power plants in a way that was neither ineffectual nor draconian. The proposal would set state-by-state limits on emissions. Now, it sounds simple, but this was a conceptual breakthrough. Much like cap and trade, it would allow market signals to indicate the most efficient ways for states to hit their targets. Instead of shutting down coal plants, some utilities might pay consumers to weatherize their homes, while others might switch some of their generators over to cleaner fuels. The flexibility of the scheme would, in turn, reduce the cost passed on to consumers. the NRDC calculates its plan would reduce our reliance on coal by about a quarter and national carbon emissions by 10%. Will it happen? Well, that's the big question right now. And the administration is taking a very low profile on this, understanding that cap and trade is not likely to ever pass. In fact, as one author put it, there's no possible scenario, not even if John Bonner were ordered to pass a cap and trade bill by a returning Jesus Christ bearing legislative text, could result in Congress passing a cap and trade law. But what this does is this leaves Obama open to pursuing new regulations as far as bringing down the emissions and the CO2 levels in our environment. And the administration is preparing for combat along with its allies. He's chosen Dennis McDonoghue, who has a deep background in climate change, to be a second-term chief of staff, and he promoted Gina McCarthy, who oversaw the rewriting of EPA regulations in his first term, to run the department. And Democratic senators are vowing to block any House Republican attempt to handcuff the EPA. Working in Obama's favor is the fact that Americans, while disturbingly blasé about climate change, do favor federal regulation of greenhouse gases by huge majorities. So in the final analysis, a muscular exercise of administrative power over environmental policy may reignite the raging anti-government paranoia that made any bipartisan cooperation impossible during the first term. However, the absence of a legislative agenda does not mean the lack of any agenda at all. All the myths of the presidency we cling to are perfectly useless here. The heavy lifting will be, by conventional political terms, invisible. The fight for Obama's second presidential term, the much-mocked fight to slow the rise of the oceans and heal the planet, requires only the simple exercise of power. Okay, well, that takes me to my third article, and this was a piece that was in the April issue of Mother Jones, written by Julia Witte. And it is, with Washington frozen solid on climate, the Navy is breaking ice. The U.S. Navy spends $4 billion a year on fuel. Navy Secretary Ray Mabus says, "You can't live off the land and sea," which is why the Navy has always looked far into the future to fuel its supply lines. The job description of admirals requires them to assess risk and solve intractable problems that stymie the rest of us. Peak oil, foreign oil, greenhouse emissions, climate change, just another bunch of enemies. So when the Department of Defense set its goal to meet 25% of its energy needs with renewables by the year 2025, the Navy found itself fighting on familiar ground. Four times in history, it has overhauled old transportation paradigms, from sail to coal to gasoline to diesel to nuclear, carrying commercial shipping with it in the process. "We are a better Navy and a better Marine Corps for innovation," Mabus says. "We have led the world in the adoption of new energy strategies in the past. This is our legacy." And it goes beyond supply lines. Rising sea levels lapping at naval bases, a melting and increasingly militarized Arctic, the Navy is tackling problems that freeze Congress solid. What it learns, what it implements, and how it adapts and innovates will drive market change that could alter the course of the world. The Navy has, as part of this program, a $510 million energy reform effort in conjunction with the Departments of Agriculture and Energy as part of a larger push to change the way the U.S. military sails, flies, marches, and thinks. And this $500 million program has five ambitious goals. The first was demonstrated this past July with the Navy's Green Fleet, a carrier strike group comprising an aircraft carrier, two guided missile destroyers, a guided missile cruiser, and an oiler, all running at least partially on alternatives to fossil fuels. The second part of this strategy is awarding Navy and the Marine Corps equipment contracts based on better fuel efficiency, and deploying a Great Green Fleet carrier strike group by 2016, phasing in hybrid fuel and electric vehicles to have petroleum use in the Navy's 5,000 commercial vehicle fleet by 2015, requiring that by 2020 each base, and there are 65,000 buildings on 2.2 million acres, be at least 50% self-powered by renewables like solar, wind, and wave energy. And finally, ensuring that at least 50% of the Navy's total energy consumption comes from alternative sources by 2020. It's an interesting article, and I would highly recommend anybody who's interested in this to find out a little bit more by going to Mother Jones. I know I'm running out of time here. But if we look back on the history of many of the great technologies that we have in this country, so many of them have come out of our armed forces. We have GPS technology. We have the Internet. We have, even going back to Ford and, you know, production line manufacturing, even that was an innovation that came out of the Army. So while our Congress dithers and fights and gets nothing done, at least we do have certain parts of our government who have decided to ignore the dysfunction and just go ahead and tackle these issues on their own. So maybe in a few years' time, we'll be able to come back with a better salute to Mother Nature. That's it, Rick. Thanks.
Well, thank you, Renee. Thank you for that important Mother's Day news from those wonderful sources. Thanks so much, and again, happy Mother's Day to all you wonderful women activists and men activists as well. You may not be a mother, but you have a mother, and that's what's important. Without mothers, this would be a very, very different world. So thank you, one and all, for all the work that you do. And also, I don't want to leave that thought of Mother's Day aside before also mentioning that we also need to continue the fight for wage equity. Equal pay for equal work has to be part of the ongoing work that we're doing to make this a better world. I've got a couple more stories I want to do before we bring on our first guest of the evening. That'll be Lisa Morano of Planned Parenthood. Tonight we also have, we're going to do a news story with a quote from Elizabeth Warren, her recent newly first introduced bill on student loans. And then also we're going to have a word from our sponsor, Legal Shield. And then we've got Mindy Fetterman, and then also Susan Glickman, who will be bringing you some very important information about the work that they're doing. So let me get into this this story from the Center for Democracy and Technology. And it's a very interesting story that you should know about. It's called Balancing Privacy and Free Expression and the Right to be Forgotten. Today, CDT, Center for Democracy and Technology, is releasing a paper analyzing the free expression implications of the proposed right to be forgotten in a draft of the European Data Protection Regulation. The right to be forgotten concept has received much attention since the DPR was first introduced. And while we understand the concerns that motivate the proposal, CDT continues to have serious misgivings about the DPR, which again is the Data Protection Regulation, approach to the concept. As described in Article 17, the right to be forgotten would put private companies in the position of balancing users' free expression and privacy rights a difficult task that's traditionally been the purview of courts and legislatures, and one that companies are not really equipped to undertake. Further, the DPR puts a heavy thumb on the scales on the side of privacy, promising high fines if companies violate the regulation, but providing only narrowly scoped safeguards for journalistic and artistic expression. The proposed Article 17 allows any user to request that an online service provider delete all data about her or him that the service provider possesses. If that information has been publicly available, data controllers are required to notify third parties that link to or have copies of the data about the deletion request. This broad conception of the right to be forgotten fails to adequately consider the free expression concerns inherent in the right to remove true, lawfully published information from the public record. Quoting and commentary are integral to free expression, yet Article 17 could chill such expression since the deletion request would extend to third-party references to data that an individual requests deletion of. Article 80 requires member states to make a limited accommodation for free expression, but that provision falls short of standards required by international human rights instruments. If adopted, the right to be forgotten, which sounds very good on the face, proposal would generate a variety of regulation to protect free expression throughout member states, creating a lack of clarity for both individuals and data processors regarding what standards apply to deletion requests and what balance must be struck between privacy and free expression. Again, you can get more information at the CDT, the Center for Democracy and Technology, their article of May 9th entitled Balancing Privacy and Free Expression in the Right to be Forgotten. Okay, next up, Fukushima news. Cooling systems were restored for four fuel storage pools at Japan's tsunami-damaged nuclear plant, more than a day after power outage halted the supply of fresh cooling water and raised concerns about the safety of the facility, which still relies on makeshift equipment. You may remember last week's story from Toby, who saw those facilities himself. We don't believe the Fukushima disaster is under control, said Yudo Endo, chief of nearby Kawachi Village, part of which remains restricted because of radiation contamination, keeping hundreds of residents away from their homes. Officials are struggling to make area livable again, but people cannot return home unless they feel confident about the plant's stability, he said. Another article on nuclear power. Dominion, Virginia Power, was in the process of restarting a plant, and the unit was 60% power shortly after 6 a.m. Friday when the operators detected greater than normal vibrations in part of the mechanism used to start the reactor. They then manually shut it down. The excessive vibrations were detected in the exciter, which is used during the startup process to initiate the flow of electricity from the generator to the grid. The exciter spins with the turbines and the electric generator on one long shaft. By mid-afternoon, our crews were able to get into the enclosure around the exciter to begin more detailed troubleshooting, said Dominion Virginia Power spokesman Jim Norville. This is a high-voltage area with exposed parts spinning at 1,800 RPM at the end of the turbine generator shaft, so the team had to wait until the shaft stopped spinning. And downwinders, fracking ourselves to death in Pennsylvania. It's from a story in Al Jazeera. More than 70 years ago, chemical attack was launched against Washington State and Nevada. It poisoned people, animals, and everything that grew. It breathed air and drank water. The Marshall Islands were also struck. This formerly pristine Pacific atoll was branded the most contaminated place in the world. As their cancers developed, the victims of atomic testing and nuclear weapons development got a name, downwinders. What marked their tragedy was the darkness in which they were kept about what was being done to them. Proof of harm fell to them, not to the U.S. government agencies responsible. Now a new generation of downwinders is getting sick as an emerging industry pushes the next wonder technology, in this case, high-volume hydraulic fracturing. Whether they live in Texas, Colorado, or Pennsylvania, their symptoms are the same: rashes, nosebleeds, severe headaches, difficulty breathing, joint pain, intestinal illnesses, memory loss, and more. In my opinion, said Yuri Gorby of the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, what we see unfolding is a serious health crisis, one that is just beginning. The process of fracking starts by drilling a mile or more vertically. then outward laterally into 500 million-year-old shale formations, the remains of oceans that once flowed over parts of North America. Millions of gallons of chemical, sand-laced water are then propelled into the ground at high pressure, fracturing the shale and forcing the methane it contains out. With the release of gas comes thousands of gallons of contaminated water. This flowback fluid, containing the original fracking chemicals, plus heavy metals and radioactive material that also lay safely buried in shale. The industry that uses this technology calls itself its product natural gas, but there's nothing natural about upending half a billion years of safe storage of methane and everything that surrounds it. It is, in fact, an act of ecological violence around which alien infrastructures, compressor stations that compress the gas for pipeline transport, ponds of contaminated flowback, flare stacks that burn off gas impurities, diesel trucks in quantity, thousands of miles of pipeline, and more have metastasized across rural America, pumping carcinogens and toxins into water, air, and soil. There's more you could get online about that. But now I want to bring on Ms. Lisa Morano of Planned Parenthood with her update from the legislature.
How's it going?
Very good. And yourself? How are you today?
I'm great, thank you.
Well, we just managed to survive another legislative session. And I know you're going around to different areas across the state and having discussions about it. Why don't you go ahead and give us an update on your take of the last 2013 legislative session here in Florida?
Absolutely. Well, like you mentioned, we at Planned Parenthood were very excited that, you know, we made it through our second consecutive legislative session without any anti-women's health legislation passing. But unfortunately, that doesn't mean that it wasn't introduced. If you remember, in 2011, we had 18 bills introduced.
Yeah.
This year, we had 8 different bills introduced. So, you know, you would have thought that after the November elections, when we overwhelmingly defeated Amendment 6, and after pro women's health candidates were elected up and down the ballot all throughout the country and locally, the legislators would have gotten the message to stop infringing upon women's reproductive options. However, they apparently did not get that message with introducing these 8 pieces of legislation this year.
You know, it seems that again and again we find ourselves with people running for office who do not proclaim crushing women's rights as a paramount need. And yet that's what they do when they get to Tallahassee. What do you think the explanation is for that?
Well, it's kind of funny you say that, because I think what we saw with last election cycle, there were some candidates that were very proudly and loudly stating that they were anti-women's health. So, you know, when in past years we didn't see that, and that was something that no one would have ever said aloud, now we see that it became a bragging right for some people. I mean, we look at someone like Aiken, who, you know, out of Missouri, who made some remarks about legitimate rape and, you know, other horrific things. And the people that were saying these anti-women remarks are no longer in office. So I really think it just shows them that when it comes to their personal views, their constituencies do not share these views. And that, you know, women, one of the largest voting blocks, do not share these views. And men don't share these views that women's reproductive rights should be infringed upon. You know, and I think it really comes down to basic political interference. You know, we as Americans want the right to make our own decisions, to be able to consult with our families and our doctors and our faith leaders about private medical decisions. And it's really disheartening to see when politicians take that step over the line and really try and infringe on these things and take rights away.
Well, you know, we did have quite a bit of discussion at the legislative level of access to health care for a broad cross-section of Floridians, and it seems that while they can find compassion for corporations, they can't seem to find any compassion for the medical needs of so many Floridians. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. I think you really summarized it well there. Through the Affordable Care Act, our legislature here in Florida had the opportunity to expand health care to the millions of Floridians that unfortunately are living without it. And rather than expand health care and accept the federal dollars that were going to pay for this health care expansion, our Florida legislators chose to drag their feet and play politics. And again, they're not just playing politics here with, you know, inanimate objects. These are real people who need health care. Through the health care expansion, the Florida legislature could have drawn down over $51 billion from the federal government. $51 billion. That's quite a chunk of change. They could have insured over 1.2 million Floridians, over half of which are women and girls. And again, this is to expand basic health care coverage for everything, for immunizations, for pregnancy, for, you know, fertility care, for basic cough and colds, for anything, for a slew of things. You know, here at Planned Parenthood, we actually have one of our volunteer youth who is in the process of applying to colleges. Unfortunately, he does not have health insurance. Because he does not have health insurance, he's not able to get the immunizations that are required for him to go to college. So his lack of health care coverage is preventing him from going to college and getting a degree. And I think that's a primary example of how the legislature has failed Floridians. Rather than accepting this health care expansion that they are obligated to do under the Affordable Care Act, they wanted to, you know, play around. And it's really unfortunate that in the 60 days of session, there could not be a compromise between the House and the Senate. And, you know, we are really calling upon Senate President Gates and Speaker Weatherford and Governor Scott to sit down as our leaders in our Florida legislature, to really sit down and flesh it out and come up with some sort of plan, because Floridians are sick, Floridians are dying, and this is something that we all deserve.
Well, you know, I think that once again, as always, the good people at Planned Parenthood have stood up for education, have stood up for information, and have stood up for basic health care. It seems that again and again, you have to continue to make the point that the primary work of Planned Parenthood is not just one thing. It is women's health care in general, family health care in general, and you provide so much in the way of general health care. In fact, for some people, the only health care that they're getting.
Absolutely. I mean, like you said, over 90% of what we do is preventative health care, and that includes everything from breast screenings to cervical cancer screenings to STD testing and birth control to prevent pregnancy and prevent abortion. But unfortunately, the media and some politicians choose to cloud the good work that we do with things that they find controversial. And, you know, it's just really sad that they take away from all the great work that we do. Something that really just shocks me every time I hear it, there's a statistic that one out of every five American women has visited a Planned Parenthood health center in her life. One out of five. That's huge. Not many organizations or brands can say that they have that kind of touch on the American population. And like you said, Rick, for many of our patients, they're not just coming to us for a gynecological exam or for HIV testing. For most of our patients, we are their only healthcare provider, period. So they're coming to see us maybe for an STD test, but then they have a cough and a cold that needs to be treated. They might need to be referred to a cancer specialist if we find something that seems like it could be a lump that's not benign. So it's really important that our doors stay open so that not only can we provide reproductive health care that's non-judgmental, that we can provide this other compassionate care to the millions of patients that we serve across the country every year.
Before I talk about some specific legislation, I do want to mention that you have some town hall meetings or some meetings coming up where you're inviting public to come forward and listen to some of the your analysis of what's happened. You want to talk about those events?
Yes, absolutely. So Planned Parenthood of South Florida is hosting four legislative briefings this week. We're having two tomorrow on Monday. We're having one in West Palm Beach at 10 a.m., one in Broward at 6 p.m., then on Wednesday, we're hosting one in Stewart at 2 p.m., and on Friday, we have one in Miami also at 10 a.m. So I know that was a lot of information, but if anyone is interested in attending, you can email publicspaceaffairs@ppflo.org, or you can call me at 561-472-9000. 9941, and that's my direct line. And again, these are legislative briefings to not only talk about the 8 pieces of legislation that Planned Parenthood was following, but you'll also hear from legislators themselves to highlight some of the work that they worked on during this legislative session. And of course, we'll have some other coalition organizations there, like ACLU, National Council of Jewish Women, some really other great partners there to share other issues that that we were looking at that affect healthcare and affect everyday Floridians. So again, those are going on this week on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. So we hope that those of you in South Florida can make it. And for those of you in other parts of the state, please contact your local Planned Parenthood affiliate. They'll be having legislative briefings all over the state in the next few weeks. So just contact us, and we're happy to have you all there.
You know, I think this is an unappreciated educational work that you guys are doing. When you think about the powerful impact that our state government has on the daily lives of Floridians, and when you consider some of the curious legislation they're proposing and in some cases, thank goodness, failing to enact, the fact that you're going out there and helping people understand what's going on, that is so necessary and so important. I can't laud you enough for that effort. If you thought about how many organizations should be helping the people to understand what's going on in the legislature, if more people did, probably we'd have a better legislature, because unfortunately a lot of people think that if they don't think about the government, it won't think about them, and that is sadly not the case. We did have some absolutely, I think, terrible legislation proposed where there were, Senate Bill 1056 and House Bill 395, where they tried to prohibit abortion under so many circumstances. And then also 1072 and House Bill 845, where they tried to, and thank goodness failed, to try to get a doctor to state in an affidavit that an abortion was not performed based on sex or race. You know, how do you continue to fight such absolutely heartless or cavalier legislation?
Well, you know, it is tough. You know, for example, when you talked about Senate Bill 1056, House Bill 395, the all-out abortion ban, that piece of legislation, if passed, would have banned abortion in all circumstances with very, very limited exceptions to save a mother's life. So it is tough to do this when this is the fourth year in a row that we've seen that same piece of legislation. But the thing that keeps us motivated, the thing that keeps us going, is all of our supporters. We know that our supporters, and quite frankly, that overall Americans, do not support these severe restrictions on women's health and severe restrictions on the ability to make personal decisions. So it's tough when we're hearing from these legislators that really want to take away, you know, access to legal, safe medical services. But we know that it's an important thing for us to protect. It's important for us to protect the right of people to consult with their doctors about their medical decisions. And it's important for Planned Parenthood to be there as a medical provider. So we just know that, you know, the 81,000 patients we serve a year in Florida are depending on us. And there's a ripple effect. Not only are our patients depending on us, but the patients of private OBGYNs, patients of hospitals that provide these services, are depending on us. So, you know, we have a lot of weight that we're carrying, being one of the only organizations that's in Tallahassee and in Washington working on these issues. But we really are proud that we are the leading organization when it comes to reproductive health and education and rights. It's something that we take very seriously and we're very proud of, and we will continue to fight no matter how many pieces of legislation we see. And, you know, looking back to last November, when we first had Amendment 6 on the ballot, you know, many said, oh, there's no way you all are going to beat that. We beat it by over 15 points. It shows the power of Planned Parenthood. It shows the power of the voter. And, you know, it shows that people want to stop political interference. And I think that's, you know, some major takeaways for us. And when you were referring to the so-called race and sex election, you know, it's more bullying. It's more of these bills that just put women in the hot seat and really point the fingers at women, rather than looking at common sense approach to reducing the numbers of abortions and to reducing the number of unintended pregnancy. And that's really what we're interested in here, is how can we educate people to reduce behaviors that might result in things that they're not comfortable with? How can we educate? How can we provide healthcare services? So we're really looking at all of the issues, not only from the aspect of a political organization, but from the aspect of an educational organization, and most importantly, as a healthcare provider, the leading reproductive health provider in the country.
Well, you know, I absolutely salute your work, and without you, I shudder to think the kind of difficulties Florida women would have. So thank you so much. Lisa, if you want to give that contact information one more time so people who want to avail themselves of this wonderful, these town hall meetings you're going to have, why don't you go ahead and give that web address or email again?
Absolutely. It's public_affairs@ppsoflo.org, or you can call me directly at 561-472-9941.
Well, Lisa, thanks again, and happy Mother's Day to you and all of yours.
Well, thank you so much for having us on. We always love coming on your show. So thank you so much for the support, and we really look forward to working with you, you know, in the meantime, up until next legislative session.
We'll be talking to you. Thanks, Lisa.
Thanks, Rick.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That was Lisa Morano.
That was Lisa Morano of Planned Parenthood of Florida. Thank you so much, and we'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Yeah, there's an echo in this world. And speaking of echo, I want to mention some of the other fine progressive broadcasters that are out there. Gwen Holden Berry and her show Here Be Monsters. It's on Sunday, the hour before us. Susan Nylon and the Nylon Report, which is on out of the Sarasota area every weekday. We also want to mention Brian Stetton and his show Progress Toward Democracy, which is, I think, Monday evenings and Friday evenings. Also, Sita Biguil and her Sita Media, which is on out of the Melbourne area. Also, Anita Stewart and her show Wise Women Media. And a special shout out to our friend and show supporter, Harriet Lehrman, and her show Voice of the People. I think it's Tuesday afternoons. So there's plenty of good broadcasters out there giving you good progressive news, and I hope you tune in. And also, I want to mention, here's a word from our sponsor.
What is Legal Shield? It's total access. It's total freedom. Everyone deserves legal protection. And now, with Legal Shield, everyone can access it. No matter how traumatic, no matter how trivial, whatever your situation is, we are there to help. From real estate to divorce advice, identity theft, and beyond. Legal Shield has your rights covered. With Legal Shield, you'll be able to talk to a dedicated, experienced attorney about whatever you want, as often as you want, for less than $20 a month, no matter what happens. Legal Shield will have you protected and empowered to worry less and live more. Please visit www.mrsdd.com. That's www.mrsdd.com. Legal Shield.
There we go. That's Legal Shield, mrsdd.com. Make sure you give them a shout. They do good work, and they're an important sponsor for us. Thanks again. And now, in just a minute, we're going to have our next guest up. That'll be Ms. Mindy Fetterman and her project, the Inner Truth Project, and she'll be on in just a moment. And I do want to mention one other story that's important and you should know about. The energy infrastructure company, TransCanada, has asked a Oklahoma judge to keep protesters away from their pipeline construction. The company's building hopes to build a 485-mile-long oil pipeline between Cushing's storage hub and refineries along the Gulf Coast. Construction is expected to be completed this summer, but crews working in Oklahoma have been hampered, that is, by about a half a dozen times by protesters affiliated with the Great Plains Tar Sands Resistance. TransCanada filed a lawsuit Monday in Atoka County seeking a temporary restraining order against the environmental group and 21 individuals involved in the protest. The judge has barred three people who already have been arrested in Atoka County from interfering with pipeline construction, but he did not rule on the others named in TransCanada's lawsuit. The group contends that the lawsuit is part of a broader campaign to criminalize dissent. A right to peacefully assemble and petition for redress of grievances? Oh my God. But here we go, ladies and gentlemen. Without any further ado, let me bring on our next guest, Miss Mindy Fetterman.
Hello.
Welcome, Mindy. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Well, you know, Mindy, you come recommended by a really good friend of the show and a wonderful woman in her own right. And I want to first wish you Happy Mother's Day.
Thank you.
And then ask you to tell us about the Inner Truth Project.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on tonight, and thank you also to the woman you refer to, Meredith Achman. She's a great supporter and friend of mine. And the Inner Truth Project started a couple of years ago in our community up here on the Treasure Coast because I myself am a survivor of childhood sexual abuse and then rape twice as an adult. And when I started to share my story and speak out, I realized that there were many, many people, men and women, just like myself, and we had no place to go to talk about this. There were a lot of people still living in secrecy and in shame, and I decided that we needed to start taking some action. And we created different events in the community that we could get out and raise awareness. And from that, it started to snowball into support groups, and now we have a center. And the center has only been open since March of this year, but it's growing very quickly.
Wow, well, it's such important work. Too many people, and we hear the stories all the time, are abused as children or suffer the abuse as adults. And we hear that the ongoing scandals in the military, it's terrible how many people have been hurt in this terribly intimate way.
It truly is a silent epidemic. And, I do a lot of work with domestic violence, and I am aware of some really phenomenal organizations in my area and beyond that work with physical abuse. And I think those things are now getting they're coming to the surface. People are feeling a little more comfortable talking about them, and we kind of understand about how to break the cycles and how to deal with it. But when it comes to childhood sexual abuse, molestation, incest, it's still so incredibly taboo and so almost nauseating for people that we just haven't even begun to understand how to deal with it, and it is so prevalent. And it's just time. It's time that we learn as a society how to talk about it, how to deal with it, and get our heads out of the sand, because it is happening everywhere, all corners of our community.
I mean, we hear about the military. We hear about these problems in churches. We hear, about problems, the recent kidnapping case. My goodness. And it's such a shame that with the social stigma makes, as you said, clearing the air even more complicated. It must have taken such power on your part to try to make a place for people to come together and share.
Well, first of all, the things that are going on that we see in the news and in the military, they're no more or less tragic than anything that I went through or anybody that I know has gone through.
Sure.
But they're very sensationalized. When you think about it, those stories make the news because they create a lot of drama. But statistically, and just even beyond that, what we know is that these things are happening right now on our street, in your neighborhood, and in homes of people that you socialize with. And so, unfortunately, it's taking, this dramatic turn of events, all the things that are coming out in the military, but it's so much deeper than that, and it's so pervasive in every single day, you know, run-of-the-mill people. And so on one hand, I'm happy that there are people brave enough in those institutions to, you know, come out and blow the whistle, so to speak, in the military or, you know, with the clergy, but it's so much bigger than that. And when I started to share, it wasn't so much that I had anticipated other people starting to share, but it was almost as if the bubble was starting to burst and people couldn't contain it anymore. And it just took one person to say, this is what the face of a survivor looks like, and you're not alone. And just in that, people started to feel like they didn't want to live in secrecy anymore. So I didn't know how quickly it would happen. I didn't know what exactly would happen. But there's definitely a momentum growing where people are starting to understand that they don't have to live in shame, in secrecy, feeling alone, and feeling like they're shaped by the incidents that had happened to them in the past.
And that's such an important point. Number one, that these people are blameless, and that those incidents don't need to define the rest of their life experience. That's so critical.
That's right. That's right. And you know, I don't have any beginnings of even being able to understand why perpetrators do what they do. And I think there's a lot of different theories. And, you know, it's not the path that I'm choosing to go down. What I really want is for people to understand that this does happen. And if it happens to you, or it has happened to you, or someone that you know, that it does not have to create the reality moving forward for defining who they are or what actions they take the rest of their lives. And, you know, people who truly look at themselves as victims and are stuck in that victimization don't understand, in my eyes, that, you know, victims stop living, survivors live. And though I don't like to put labels on it, I really wish that more and more people could see themselves as survivors, and knowing that the things that happen to them happen, but they don't dictate the rest of their lives, and that they can move forward.
Now, let me ask you this. When you started this project, I'm sure it was to help just a small circle of friends or acquaintances, and then this thing has grown. Now, is Inner Truth a residential space or just a meeting place? Tell us about the Inner Truth project, how it's evolved.
Yeah, thank you for asking that. You know, what we started to do was, like I said, kind of create some awareness in the community. And one of the first things we did in 2011 is we had a Take Back the Night event. And that's a typical kind of activist event that happens on big college campuses. And it's usually in reaction to some type of violent incident that happens on campus. And we felt like we wanted to be proactive and bring people out and march through the streets, proclaiming that the streets were ours. We didn't have to feel ashamed or unsafe going out at night because we were either women or because women or men and had in the past been victimized in some way, that we could still feel free. And so we marched through the streets, and at the end of that, we had a speak out. And the speak out was something where we created this safe environment, and we passed around the microphone and said, tonight is the night. If you've been holding the secret and you want to let it go, this is a safe place to do so. And so in creating this first event, I really had no idea if people were going to show up, if they showed up, if they were going to share, and what was going to happen. And we had over 100 people that came out that night, and one person after another, taking the microphone, a 67-year-old African-American grandmother with 5 grandchildren, married to a pastor, took the microphone and she said she had never, ever shared that she had been molested her entire childhood, and she just broke down in tears. And we had 2 elected officials who took the microphone, and they shared their stories. One was a man. And the energy and the vibe in that event just started to change the community. And it was a definite ripple effect that you could feel. And from that, people started to say, what's next? Where can we go? What services are available? And that's how the Inner Truth Project started to grow. It wasn't just now about bringing awareness, but what are we going to do to start to heal? What's the next step? So the center is 2,900 square feet, and it's actually in a warehouse area, but we've created it to look like a warm, inviting, safe living room with different counseling rooms and different meeting rooms. And, you know, for me, I felt like I could pull something together and take some donations and put some posters on the wall. But I know that in particular for the women that I knew in my inner circle, so many of them had lived in shame and felt dirty and felt worthless for so much of their lives that were second rate almost. And I wanted to create a place where they walked in and they felt they were loved and it was done 100% the right way and it was beautiful and it was representative of who they were. So when you walk into this place in the middle of this industrial park, you're kind of blown away that how gorgeous it is. You know, it's very upscale and it's one main room where we do our support group and we have 12-step groups. Then we have individual private rooms for the therapists that are going to be working there. And then we have a room for body work because a lot of women who have gone through any type of violence are really disconnected from their body and haven't even begun to, besides connecting with their body, deal with the memories that are stored in their body. So we have yoga for PTSD and Pilates for trauma victims and meditation and breath work and those types of things. And then we have another huge room, which is our media room, where we show films of all sorts relating to abuse, and also we'll be bringing in speakers and doing workshops that cover a whole range of topics, so that it's really a holistic approach to being a survivor.
Wow, that's great. You know, you raise an important issue. I was wondering, is it predominantly at this point peer-to-peer discussions, or do you have some mental health professionals involved already?
Well, the support group is peer-to-peer, and it's very loose, and it's basically just come, listen, share if you want to, look somebody else in the eye and understand that you are not going through this alone. So we have that. We also do have therapists that are coming on board shortly, different types of therapists, because not all therapy is for all people.
Sure.
There's a group of women that are coming to the support group, and they're really looking for a more religious group, and so that will be started too. You know, not anything that I necessarily have to facilitate. There will be a different facilitator. So really anything that we can offer that's going to help somebody, we want to do. Some of it will be with professionals, some of it's peer-to-peer, some of it is just knowing that there's a place. So you can just begin to even think about, maybe I want to tell somebody, maybe I want to take the next step. So sometimes it's not even actually that the women are coming, but they're learning about it and they're starting to change the way they even deal with it secretly so that they can maybe hopefully take the next step and reach out to one other person.
Oh, let me ask you this. The evolution of this facility, when did it open?
It opened in March. And, you know, we had already been holding the support group out in the community. So right away, we were able to move it to our permanent location, and we offer it twice a month, the second and last Thursday of the month. And, you know, it's a really great location because, like I said, it's in a warehouse. So it's very quiet and very secluded, but it's very easy to get to off of 95. It's up in Port St. Lucie. And, the location's really easy for women that are coming from Indian River, from Martin County, and even out from Okeechobee County. And I actually have one woman that's been coming up from West Palm, which is great.
I imagine that you guys have an interface with some of the women's shelters or family shelters, such as they are in the Treasure Coast area.
Well, I actually sit on the board of Safe Space, which is the area's only domestic violence shelter and outreach service organization. They do a phenomenal job. They have two physical locations that service shelters for women and their families, but they do not have a shelter directly in St. Lucie County. And the great thing is that we're able to, we're talking about being able to offer services such as support groups for those women who are going through domestic violence situations or classes so that we can educate and, you know, planting the seed that this facility will be for empowering women and their families. So whether or not they are in a domestic situation or recovering from some type of sexual violence, even though that's the primary focus, you know, we'll be able to connect with all of these other great institutions because there's a lot of really wonderful providers in the area. They just don't specifically deal with this.
Wow, this sounds like one of those services that has literally been called into being because there was such a great need for it. You must be a very strong person because you have had to deal with this in yourself first before you could take these steps. You must have a great deal of character and inner strength yourself. When you were first coping with this in your adulthood, did you have supportive friends or did you literally have to seek people out to to get help yourself?
I thank you for saying that, and I'm just laughing because I ate a whole lot of chocolate today, so I'm thinking about my inner strength. but it's Mother's Day, right? So, you know. it's a process, and I appreciate your words, but I am not any different than anybody else, and I, you know, have a long road ahead of me, and I think it's, you know, day to day. But I do know that I have been extremely lucky that I started sharing my story and I started my whole healing process. I also got a lot of support from the people in my 12-step groups that I was going to, from my husband and my husband's family, and then slowly my friends started to understand what I was going through. They've all been phenomenal.
So, you know, a question that I ask all my guests who are doing work to make this a better world, what was it that made you take that step beyond your own healing, your own internal processing? What made you take that step to say, I want to be part of creating that safe space, that healing place? Because I think that's so important. I think that that's so inspirational to people to hear how you went from being a victim to someone who says, I'm going to take charge of this. I'm going to not only help myself, but I'm going to help others. I'm going to make that space happen. What was it for you that turned that switch for you?
Well, there were three major points that happened, major events. And one was early in this process. I'm also a recovering alcoholic and drug addict. I'm 14 years clean and sober. And so in the meetings, thank you so much, dealing with those things, talking about, you know, all my issues in these groups, I had one particular group who I just felt like every week we were coming together and we were rehashing some of our stuff, and it was miserable. It was heartbreaking, and it was really just being stuck. And I felt like I'm not living in the solution. I'm not moving past this. I keep revisiting all of these hurts and this violence, but I'm not getting anywhere. And I said something in one of the groups, and I said, you know, I feel like we're living like we're dead, like there's no hope. But I'm young and I have the whole rest of my life ahead of me, and I don't want to be in this pain anymore. And it was just that light bulb going off that I realized that I no longer had to live rehashing it and being ashamed of it because I was so tired of hearing these other people do the same thing. Of course, I was not asked to come back to that meeting, but that's okay. and I moved on from that, and I started to share with different people who really supported my desire to change my life. And then at the time, who's now my husband, my fiance's family kind of stepped up and said, you know, we believe everything that you're telling us that has happened to you, and we want to help you. We want to offer whatever resources you need. And it was the first time that people outside of maybe like my girlfriend, my close friend, they validated my feelings. They believed in me. They felt like I wasn't fabricating any part of my life. And that really helped me turn a corner, because for the first time I felt like I had people in my life who believed in me and were willing to stick by me and not judge me for what had happened. So it was a combination of those two things that really helped me start opening up to a wider audience. And then when my husband, several years ago, he was an elected official and he was working on some legislation that dealt directly with victims and helping them, when he was putting all of the details together, he said, "Mindy, I feel like if we put a face to the story, if we put a face to this piece of legislation and I can share it, I think people will truly understand how it doesn't just affect the individual person who's been victimized, but how it truly affects all of us as a community." So he asked me for my permission. I gave him my blessing to share part of my story, and he sent out an email, which I did not know was going to 5,000 people, but I guess when you're an elected official, you have the ability to do that. And that's when it truly did change, because the response was so overwhelming. He shared part of my story in Tallahassee on the House floor and started to talk about how this had affected him personally, how he had watched it affect his wife. And then he started to get responses from other legislators. "Thank you. This happened in my house. This happened to my wife. This happened to my sister." And that kind of was the impetus to say, something big is happening here. People are ready to hear somebody share their story so that they can understand that they're not alone and they can share theirs too. And it was really when he made it so public that people all of a sudden started to connect with me. And it became so much bigger than me, and I had no plans for it. You know, I truly was doing the things that I was doing to help myself. And that's the truth. It was part of my journey to heal my own past. But as people started to approach me and talk to me, I realized that all of a sudden I was the only person speaking out, and it was actually helping people. And then, you know, you can't turn back from that. And it just felt so natural that anytime I would go anywhere, any meeting, any group, I would just stand up and share as openly and honestly as I could, because almost every single time I would do that, people would stop me at the door. "Thank you for talking. Thank you for sharing. Thank you for saying what you did. I've never told anybody this, but it happened to me too." I hear it all the time. And so once you hear that, you know, it's, I can't stop this. I can't turn back, and I'm letting it go its natural course, but it was time. It is something that's missing in our community, and somehow I was the person that, you know, was the facilitator to start it, and I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but I know that we can't stop now. We have to keep being honest and allowing more and more people to talk about it.
Well, we've talked about this now for a few minutes, and I think it's time you told people how they can get in touch with you and your organization to support it.
That would be wonderful. We not only are always looking for more people to join us, but we do need financial support. And our website's going live next week. But in the meantime, it's a great avenue to find out what we're doing. It's Facebook, Inner Truth Project on Facebook. The really cool thing about our Facebook page is that a lot of people have sent me private messages sharing their story with the permission that I can cut and paste it and put it in the main feed. And then people comment and respond to that note. And it's really wonderful, because if you're one of the people who shared and you see other people responding to what you wrote, that it happened to them or the details or similar, something like that, it's very healing. So the Facebook page is a great tool, but it'll also give you our physical address. And it'll give you the dates and times that we meet and where you can send donations. The website is www.innertruthproject.org. And we have an event coming up on the 23rd of this month, a Thursday, LunaFest, which is a film festival that was put out starting in 2000 by the makers of Lunabar. And there's short films, 9 short films, all about women and different issues that women deal with. Everything from cancer to motherhood to relationships and self-esteem. And it's going to be a wonderful night. the proceeds of that, the tickets for that night, are coming back to us so that we can directly help women with their services. 18% of it's going to the cancer fund, the breast cancer fund, sorry. So you can get tickets also from the Facebook page or at the website, because there's a PayPal link. So even if you can't get the information immediately, because I, like I said, it's going live next week, it'll still link you to the donation page.
Mindy, this is such a wonderful thing. If you were to speak to somebody out there who's still holding that secret to themselves, out of fear, out of hurt, out of a sense of valuelessness, what advice do you give to people? What do you tell someone who says to you, I haven't told anyone this?
Well, I have to tell you honestly, I'm a little cautious to give advice to anybody. I just try to do my own thing, and, you know, it's just like they say in recovery, you take what you like and you leave the rest. I've met a lot of people who have said to me, I will never share my story, and that's okay. But what I would say, if there's somebody listening, I would say take the first step, even if it's writing a message on Facebook, because it really does move you into that place of being in the solution, because immediately you will have responses where people will tell you that you are not alone. And I think that all of a sudden, even though it's cliche and we hear it all the time, and we hear it certainly with all types of issues, you know, cancer, domestic violence, anything like that, you're not alone. But this is so different because you truly do carry it around like it's your fault. And that it really is so heinous and dirty. And when you start to put it out there, you realize all the extra fear of being blamed and being judged has just kind of been another tool to keep you as a victim. So the very first time you get a sense that you can share with somebody, even if it's on Facebook, even if it's anonymous, you will begin to understand that you truly are whole. And that's my hope, is that somebody will just take that risk, because what they've already been through is the worst of it, and it can't get any worse. It can only get better. So take that step and share with somebody, one person, just try it. And, you know, the worst thing that can happen is your fear comes true and then you're still right where you're at. But I don't think that ever happens. I really think people are pleasantly surprised at how good it feels to kind of let that off their shoulders and take a big sigh and understand that they're perfect exactly how they are and that it's not their fault.
How often does Inner Truth meet at your facility?
Well, the Inner Truth Center is open now. The schedule will be online soon, like I said, when the website is up, and it'll tell about the different classes and the different groups and all the meeting times as we start to develop our schedule. In the meantime, the support group meets twice a month, the second Thursday and last Thursday of the month at 6:30 to 8 p.m.
Wow, Mindy, this has been really a tremendous story that you're telling. And I thank you on behalf of all those people who've been so hurt. And thank you for the work that you're doing. Why don't you go ahead and give the web address one more time?
Sure. It's www.innertruthproject.org. And you can also find us on Facebook. And the last thing I would just say is, you know, it's so important that people understand that sexual abuse, incest, rape, it doesn't discriminate. It doesn't matter what part of the community you live in. It doesn't matter the color of your skin, your nationality, your age. It doesn't matter what gender you are. It doesn't matter what size your pants are. It really is something that is prevalent in all corners of our society, and it's going to take our entire community to start to heal.
Well, thanks again. Thank you so much, and I hope you come back again soon. And thank you to our dear friend, Ms. Ackman, and the wonderful work that she does in so many ways. Thanks, Meredith, and thank you, Mindy.
Yes, thank you, and thank you, Meredith. She had a birthday yesterday, so I don't know if you sing, but you could definitely sing her a song off air.
Will do.
Thank
Will
you so
do.
Much.
Okay, Mindy, we'll talk to you soon, and hopefully those of you who know how important this is, please share what you can with Project Inner Truth. Thanks again, Mindy, and good night.
Good night. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. And now, ladies and gentlemen, we've got our last guest of the evening, Ms. Susan Glickman of the Southern Alliance for Energy. And here we go, Ms. Glickman.
Hi, Welcome. Rick. How are you?
Very good. Very good, Susan. Thank you so much for making the time for us tonight.
Sure, you bet. My pleasure.
Why don't you tell us about Southern Alliance for Energy?
Yes, absolutely. It's Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, and that's a regional group headquartered in Knoxville, Tennessee, and working in the South, of course. And we have offices in Atlanta and Charleston and Asheville, North Carolina, and Florida, and work pretty much across the region in Alabama and Louisiana. We are really focused on trying to give people better energy choices, and we care about sort of the environment and the pollution that comes from bad energy choices, and we also, you know, want to protect consumers so that we are getting the least cost options for our energy needs. And I know we're going to talk a little bit about what went on in the Florida legislature, but the 21st century is really sort of a different world in energy, and it's not going to be as much about selling electricity as it's about meeting energy need, and technologies have really changed that allow us to use a lot less energy, and we're really finding ourselves in the shift where the more traditional kind of business model of utilities, where they want big centralized power they own and control, and that's really giving way to, you know, cleaner forms of energy and more distributed generation. So it's kind of an exciting time, and I think we're really, not only in the country, but in the world, at a real crossroads.
You know, not quite off topic, but just an ironic element. About a year ago, I was out in Denver, Colorado, and they held a green energy festival. And they invited vendors who sold all kinds of energy products to solar-powered lawnmowers and green coffins and solar cookers. And, you know, I just couldn't help but think, you know, here I am in the Rockies where, you know, we all know that those of us who are familiar with Deer, Colorado know that the temperature can change five times drastically in an afternoon. And yet they're having this green energy event here in what's called, maybe ironically, the Sunshine State. I've never seen one of those.
Well, we can talk a little bit about that. The policies in Florida, Colorado's actually done a pretty darn good job of moving clean energy. They have a 33% renewable portfolio standard, which is a target for meeting renewable energy. And ironically, I think it might have been 2 years ago or so, I was sitting in a committee meeting up in the Florida legislature and, you know, just looking at my telephone and my emails coming through, and I get action alerts and Google alerts for news, and I watched Colorado had raised their renewable portfolio standard, and I was sitting in meetings trying for Florida to even have one in the first place, and we don't. The investor-owned utilities in Florida, which covers 75% of the state, are incredibly powerful, and their business model works like this. They get a guaranteed range of a rate of return on their capital expenditures. So they make more money the more they spend. And it's not unlike if you go to a restaurant, you have a big party, a party of six or eight, and they put an automatic tip on. It's like that. They just automatically make money. So they're incentivized to build the most expensive power plants. And the disincentive is on helping people use less energy. And in other states, there is a concept called decoupling, where you separate rates from profits, and they can make money helping people be more efficient, and then everybody wins. So it's, you know, and energy is not the only area. The Florida is a place where it seems like there's sort of a transactional nature and relationship between interest groups, be they the insurance companies or the oil companies or the energy companies or the tobacco companies, have an enormous amount of influence in the Florida legislature. We're not the only state, but we certainly seem to bring it up to an art form.
It's remarkable, terribly, terribly black humor to think that this sunshine state of ours makes such little use of solar power. And, of course, when we raise that issue too often, we're told that, well, FPNL has a wonderful record of wind farms here and there and solar fields here and there, and yet they don't seem to be sharing that with Floridians. And so many other states allow their customers, if they're generating their own power, to bill back the utility. And again, we've been, I guess, protected.
Well, that we actually do have.
Oh, we do have that now?
That's a concept called net metering. But let me mention, because Florida Power and Light is the biggest utility in the state, they cover about, if you put the two biggest ones, Progress Energy and now Duke, and FPL together, that's about half the state alone. But their parent company is called Next Era Energy, and they do compete in 28 states, and they're the biggest wind providers and then their biggest solar providers. They don't compete here because they have a monopoly. And the reason the franchise agreement and the reason they get this guaranteed rate of return always traditionally was so they would have the financial wherewithal not to charge people for power plants until they come online. In 2006, in a very extraordinary sort of departure from that, they passed a law, the Florida legislature did, that allows investors and utilities to recover costs in advance of the power plant coming online for new nuclear and transmission lines and also coal gasification, although no one's building that. And so this session, that was sort of the big issue on energy, was this idea of pulling back and putting some additional kind of protections and levers in that early cost recovery law, because the utilities, in fact, Southern Alliance for Clean Energy has had a case that was just sort of dismissed in the Supreme Court as saying that they didn't have kind of the authority to rule on that, and that was more of a legislative matter. We brought a case to the Florida Supreme Court because it's our belief that neither Progress Energy nor Florida Power and Light really intend on building those nuclear power plants, yet they're charging people for them now. So they did pass a law this session, Senate Bill 1472, and it does put some additional sort of process levers where for the Florida Public Service Commission can look at reasonable costs and prudency and feasibility and some of these other what are term of arts and energy to sort of rein in the costs. Nuclear power is just so incredibly expensive, and that's why we don't really believe that the utilities are planning to do that, to build those plants. When the law was first passed, they were supposed to be $5 or $6 billion, and now they're $25 billion each. And we would submit, one of the reasons why I told you earlier Southern Alliance for Clean Energy considers itself in part a consumer group is because if you can get two or three or four times as much energy for the same amount of money with energy efficiency or other forms of renewables, you know, why wouldn't you do that? And nuclear certainly has a serious issue around waste. Currently, there's a two-year moratorium on new licenses under a ruling what's called the waste confidence issue, because they just flat out don't have a place to put the nuclear waste. So
it's only a problem for, 15,000 years or so, right?
Yeah, exactly. Picky, right? It's almost, it's sort of stupefying to me that in all this discussion of nuclear, so many people, particularly policymakers, just seem to ignore that entire, waste issue and even other safety-related issues. They seem to act like nuclear is benign, and the nuclear industry's done a great job of putting out kind of this nuclear is safe, clean, and cheap. And I tell people, I said, let me tell you what's cheap. If you can find a 30-year-old depreciated nuclear power plant that's working, that would be cheap. But when you have to go build a new one, You know, we're competing with China and India for copper, steel, and concrete, and it's just flat out expensive. So anyway, there's so many less expensive ways and less risky ways to meet our energy needs.
Yeah, it seems that there's no half-life to wind power, and you certainly don't have to worry about the long-term waste issues for geothermal, and yet we have our legislators bending over backwards. Can you characterize those fine tuning of the giveaway?
Yeah, it's the interesting thing about it is this requires a rigorous Florida Public Service Commission, and that's not something that we've had.
What is that? A rigorous public service commission?
Yeah. Well, but sort of like the good news and the bad news is there's some additional kind of levers. The utility has to petition the commission before recovering pre-construction costs other than the licensing costs, and there's a test, or criteria is probably the best word, that the plant remains feasible and that the projected costs are reasonable. And that's a lever that would allow a Florida Public Service Commission that is doing its job and being rigorous to say these costs aren't reasonable anymore. And it was interesting in this Florida Supreme Court case when I was there for the oral arguments that the justices were asking questions, and Peggy Quince, one of the justices, sort of came close to the essential question, which is, has the Public Service Commission ever denied either of the utilities even $1? And they have not. So, you know, for, gosh, the last 10 or so years where I've been in and out of the Public Service Commission, I've, not just this current crop of commissioners, but traditionally, they've been very utility-friendly. About a year and a half ago, a Fort Lauderdale Sun Sentinel reporter did a story that Florida Power and Light had 24 either staff, former staff, or former commissioners working for them.
I was going to say the revolving door concept seems to be probably applicable.
Oh, there's no question about it. And the former public counsel, which is the person supposed to be representing the public's interest in proceedings, J.R. Kelly's the current public counsel, but that crop of 24 included a former public counsel. So the influence of money is extraordinary, and I'm going to use that in the largest sense because it can also be hiring people, as well as they give money to directly to campaigns, they give money to the political parties, take big chunks of money, and then they have political committees, and they do golf tournaments, and then they give to the Habitat for Humanity and all sorts of ways that they take money. And all the utilities have boxes at the sports events, the, you know, Tampa Bay Bucks or the Tampa Bay Rays. And so it wields an enormous amount of influence. And people, it was almost shocking that there even was a bill this session at all. You start out at the beginning of the session or when there's a debate and discussion about what could possibly happen in the session or what. And, you know, it's like if the utilities don't want it, you know, it just, people would just sort of roll their eyes and just say, nope, that's not happening, you know. So it's a really extraordinary. Years ago I did tobacco policy for about 5 years, and Florida was one of the first states to settle in the Master Settlement Agreement. And Governor Lawton Childs instituted this tobacco prevention program. It had a $60, $70 million budget the first year, and it was, you know, student groups, and they did this big truth campaign, which became modeled all over the country, and it was a...
They just didn't want them to be too effective.
Yeah, well, it was extremely effective, and when Jeb Bush became governor, his Secretary of Health had written a letter, I used to carry it around and show it to lawmakers, said that it saved $1 billion in long-term health care costs and kept 25,000 kids from smoking and theoretically dying. And when Jeb Bush became governor, the legislature's response to that was to kill the program. And ultimately, the American Cancer Society and the Heart Association and the Lung Association and the group I worked with, which was the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, they actually went and ran a ballot measure and put it into the state constitution, which is not really where it ought to be, but when the legislators won't do the right thing. They did the same thing with workplace smoking. Everybody's very used to now going into restaurants, and you can't smoke anymore. You can only smoke in bars with mostly no food. That was a result of a ballot measure, because year after year, the public health advocates would go to the legislature, and they wouldn't do it because they influenced the tobacco industry. So the point I want to make is it's not just about energy. You know, the unique situation about energy that I think is particularly frustrating is at the heart and soul of it, you know, they're using your money, you know, to fight against your best interests. You know, they would tell you that technically money they would use to lobby or for political contributions comes out of shareholder money, but where did the shareholder money come from? So, but truly it's every single, you know, subject matter, and it's just one of the reasons why I think, you know, things have become are so expensive, and, you know, because there's a lot of money going out the door, you know, to keep policies the way they are. So anyway,
yeah,
that's why
$14
people have
$14 billion worth of tax.
Democracy is not a spectator sport.
That's for sure. Is there any good news on the horizon?
Well, I think the good news was is that they dealt with something this session. I mean, there was a lot of discussion on energy. It allowed us, what we are trying to press for in the process is an integrated resource planning process. Because of what I said earlier, they make more money the more they spend. We want to realign those incentives and have a least cost planning process so that you can allow energy efficiency to compete with supply side. So you put demand and you put supply on a level playing field, and we can get much better outcomes. And the good news is that the world's just moving on, and the cost for new technologies is just getting cheaper, and the utilities sort of business model is crumbling, because what happens as the cost for solar comes down, more people invest in it, and then the rate base of the existing utilities shrinks. And therefore, the costs go up, and then more people, you know, go off the grid or go invest in solar. And you've got, I kind of kiddingly call it a feedback loop, which is a phrase people use about the permafrost melting. Once you get into that feedback loop, and it's going to be a feedback loop, but for clean energy and solar, because the costs are coming down. So that's really the good news. You know, in Florida, we send $50 billion a year out of state to buy fuel, because we don't make, you know, it's none of it's homegrown. So it's not coming from here. So can you imagine if I was king or governor for the day, you know, that would be my guiding principle, is let's keep those energy dollars or some part of those energy dollars here right at home, and let's not send it. We send $1.56 billion goes out of state for coal, $300 million of which goes to Colombia. So let's put Florida farmers to work, you know, and create a market there. So we need people to yell and scream and call their lawmakers and all of that, because otherwise, you know, the influence through the relationships and the money, each one of the utilities probably has 25 or 30 lobbyists that are like contract lobbyists. They're people who usually have special relationships and, you know, with lawmakers, and they all give money. And I mean, it's sort of a bit of an insidious process. That's for sure.
Let me ask you this: for people who want to get involved and want to get more information, how can they get in touch with your organization?
Yes, just go to cleanenergy.org. And you can sign up there for free for email alerts, you know, like our Facebook page, and we will send out, you know, action alerts and things when there are issues where people can weigh in. And I know it probably doesn't feel that way, but it makes a huge difference when people pick up the phone and put a call into their lawmaker, or, you know, somehow, you know, meet them or go to some event that they have, and you go up to them and you talk about energy and, you know, I heard about what Colorado's doing. How is it that we can't do more of that? You know, it's kind of comical, the myths that are often put out there. And I've been working on energy issues for more than a dozen years. And if I had a dollar for every time I heard utility folks say, you know, we can't do solar in Florida because we have intermittent cloud cover. And I think they're banking on people not knowing what intermittent means. And, you know, Germany has the cloud cover of Alaska. And they're going great guns with solar, and we certainly have a much stronger. We're not Arizona, you know, we're not Palm Springs Desert, but we've got pretty darn good sun. And again, part of what's happening with new technologies is they're able to be more efficient, you know, with lower radiation rates. And it's the same thing with wind. You know, the wind turbines are able to be more efficient at lower wind speeds. So those technologies are changing.
Not to mention thermal, for God's sakes.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I think you're going to see a lot more with fuel cells in neighborhoods. I know Bloom Energy is really interested in coming into the state. So it's going to surpass it. I was just saying, you know, while we were sleeping, Florida missed an incredible economic opportunity. You know, we could be developing these technologies more of right here in the state. Had we kept on that track. So it saddens me as a Floridian and someone who'd love to see those jobs and those technologies. I mean, we have this infrastructure over on the Space Coast where the manned space shuttle missions have wind down, and it's shocking to me how little has been done to help transition that community that has tremendous brain power and physical
engineering expertise. Yeah,
it's amazing. I work on that every day. I'm trying to bring a hydrogen generating station to Kennedy Space Center. Anyway, it's going to be a whole new economy and around, you know, sort of low carbon energy sources. And as I said, it's unfortunate Florida's pretty much on the sidelines, so the innovations will probably come from somewhere else, and we will join the party eventually because, you know, there just really isn't going to be any other choice.
As soon as the bribes sit in. Susan,
yes.
Thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate your insight, and I hope you'll come back again sometime soon.
Absolutely. Thank you for
Thanks
having
again.
Me.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Susan Glickman of the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. A wonderful insight into the legislators' actions on hopefully cutting back some of that free money for the nuclear industry. Now I'd like to bring you this excerpt of Senator Elizabeth Warren talking about student loans.
Mr. President.
The Senator from Massachusetts.
Mr. President, on July 1st, the interest rate on new federally subsidized student loans is set to double from 3.4 to 6.8%. That means unless Congress acts, for millions of young people, the cost of borrowing money to go to college will double. The student debt problem in this country is a quiet but growing problem. Today's graduates carry more than $1 trillion in debt, more than all the outstanding credit card debt in the whole country. Doubling interest rates on new student loans will just increase pressure on our young people. Now, keep in mind, these young people didn't go to the mall and run up charges on a credit card. They worked hard, they stayed in class, they learned new skills, and they borrowed what they needed to pay for an education. Their education will improve their opportunities in life, but their education won't just help those students. When they acquire more skills, these students will help us build a strong and competitive economy. They will strengthen our middle class. Student interest rates are set to double in less than 2 months, but so far Congress has done nothing to address this problem. Now, some people say we can't afford to help our kids through school by keeping student interest rates low. But right now, as I speak, the federal government offers far lower interest rates on loans every single day. They just don't do it for everyone. Right now, a big bank can get a loan through the Federal Reserve discount window at a rate of about 0.75%. But this summer, a student who's trying to get a loan to go to college will pay almost 7%. In other words, the federal government is going to charge interest rates 9 times higher than the rates they charge the biggest banks, the same banks that destroyed millions of jobs and nearly broke the economy. That isn't right. And that's why I'm introducing legislation today to give students the same deal we give to the big banks. The Bank on Students Loan Fairness Act would allow students who are eligible for federally subsidized Stafford loans to borrow at the same rate that the big banks get through the Federal Reserve discount window. For 1 year, the Federal Reserve would make funds available to the Department of Education to make loans to students at the same low rates offered to the big banks. This will give students relief from high interest rates while giving Congress a chance to find a long-term solution. Now, some may say, we can't afford this proposal. I would remind them that the federal government currently makes 36 cents in profit for every dollar that it lends to students. Add up those profits and you'll find that next year, student loans will bring in $34 billion. Meanwhile, the banks pay interest that is 1/9 the amount that students will be asked to pay. That's just wrong. It doesn't reflect our values. We shouldn't be profiting from our students who are drowning in debt while we're giving a great deal to the big banks. We should be investing in our young people so they can get good jobs and grow the economy. So let's give them the same great deal that the banks get. Now, some explain that the banks get exceptionally low interest rates because the economy is still shaky and banks need access to cheap credit to continue the recovery. But our students are just as important to the economic recovery as our banks, and the debt they carry poses a serious risk to that recovery. In fact, in March of this year, the Federal Reserve said that because of the economic impact on family budgets, high levels of student debt pose a risk to our shaky economic recovery. If the Federal Reserve can float trillions of dollars to large financial institutions at low interest rates to grow the economy, surely they can float the Department of Education the money to fund our students, keep us competitive, and help grow our middle class. Let's face it, banks get a great deal when they borrow money from the Fed. In effect, the American taxpayer is investing in those banks. We should make the same kind of investment in our young people who are trying to get them an education. Lend them the money, make them pay it back, but give our kids a break on the interest they pay. Let's bank on students. The Bank on Students Loan Fairness Act is my first standalone bill in the United States Senate. I'm introducing this bill because our students are facing a crisis. We cannot stand by and simply watch. This is about our students, our economy, and our values. The Bank on Students Loan Fairness Act is a first step toward helping young people who are drowning in debt. Unlike the big banks, students don't have armies of lobbyists and lawyers. They have only their voices, and they call on us to do what is right. Thank you.
That was Senator Elizabeth Warren making her first introduction of a bill in the U.S. Senate. Let's wish her the best of luck. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you for joining us tonight with Progressive News Network, and hope you join us next week when, as we say here, there's a better world a-coming. All we have to do is work on it.
There's a better world that's a-coming, tell you why. There's a better world that's a-coming, tell you why. We will beat them on the land, on the sea and in the sky. There's a better world that's coming, I'll tell you why. There's a better world that's coming, don't you see, see, see. There's a better world that's coming, don't you see. When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world that's coming, don't you see. There's a better world a coming, and don't you know, no, no. There's a better world that's a coming, don't you know. I'm a union man in a union war. It's a union world I'm fighting for. There's a better world that's a coming, don't you know. There's a better world that's a coming. There's a better world that's a coming. There's a better world that's a coming. I'll tell you why, don't you see, see, see. And don't you know, no, no. There's a better world that's coming, tell you why. Better world that's coming, tell you why. Out of marching, out of battling, you can hear the chains are rattling. There's a better world that's coming, tell you why. Now there's a better world that's coming, and there's a better world that's coming, and there's a better world that's coming, and I'll tell you why. There's a better world that's a-coming, I'll tell you why. Better world that's a-coming, I'll tell you why. We'll beat them on the land, in the sea and in the sky. There's a better world that's a-coming, I'll tell you why. Well, there's a better world that's a-coming, don't you see. Better world that's a-coming, don't you see. When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world a-coming, don't you see. There's a better world a-coming, don't you see?